Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, many thanks for coming along tonight in this inclement Sydney weather. Martin Ferguson makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He was here some years ago in the difficult years of opposition, but it's great to have him back as a minister. I'll introduce him briefly because he's well known to you. He was educated at Sydney University, where he studied economics. Then he had an extended career in the trade union movement and was president of the ACTU between 1990 and 1996. He went into politics as the Labour member for Batman in 1996, held a number of senior positions in the opposition, in the Labour opposition, and then, of course, after the election of the Rudd Labour government, became Minister for Resources and Energy and then Minister for Tourism. So Mr. Ferguson is currently Minister of Resources and Energy and Tourism. And he's going to speak to us tonight on the important topic of Australia as an energy powerhouse. Minister, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, thanks very much, Gerard. Ladies and gentlemen, I can firstly say it's a pleasure to be here again this evening. As Gerard said, it's my first address to the Sydney Institute as the Minister for Resources and Energy and Minister for Tourism. In actual fact, I last spoke to the Institute in 2006 in August, when I was the then Shadow Minister for these portfolios. And I must say it's far more pleasurable to actually come along as a minister, to actually have a chance to attend to some of these issues in government, rather than try, as I did in previous days, to actually argue for necessary change from opposition. Let's go back to 2006 and consider where we were then and where we are today. I remind you that back in 2006, the reality of the China boom was still emerging, and global...
Land rights, not dump sites! Break the nuclear chain! Land rights, not dump sites! Break the nuclear chain! Land rights, not dump sites! Break the nuclear chain! Land rights, not dump sites! Break the nuclear chain. Land rights, not dump sites. Break the nuclear chain. Land rights, not dump sites. Break the nuclear chain. Land rights, not dump sites. Break the nuclear chain. Land rights, not dump sites. Break the nuclear chain. Land rights, not dump sites. Break the nuclear chain. Land rights, not dump sites. Break the nuclear chain.
I'm actually pleased I have a fan club. Must say I'm pleased they're here this evening rather than normally outside my electorate office in Preston. And clearly we have a group of people who are not interested in the benefits of nuclear medicine in Australia. But let's go to the reality, because in some ways they actually raise some of the hard issues that we have to confront as a nation. And I'm more than willing to actually take questions on our requirement to actually establish a new nuclear repository, a process, interestingly, I might remind you, we started in 1988. But clearly I'm more than willing to actually take questions on that complex matter this evening. But as I was saying, in terms of where we are, back in 2006, the reality of the China boom was still emerging, and global fears about energy security were looming in the minds of policy makers, as oil prices passed the US $70 a barrel mark, hitting record territory in that time. In my last address to the Institute, I reflected on the fact that fears about energy security were being fueled by a variety of issues. They included instability in exporting nations, the threat of terrorism, a nationalist backlash, a scramble for resources, and the fundamental desire of nations to protect their own economic growth. I also noted that this insecurity was placing the world in danger of retreating. In the open markets and free trade we have worked so hard to achieve since the Second World War. More oil-producing countries were nationalising their industries, sending away vital foreign investment and industry capability. The scramble for resources is global, driven by a fear that China's unprecedented growth and insatiable demand might limit access for other nations. I was compelled to agree at the time in opposition with the then Treasurer, Peter Costello, who said, and I quote, "The best energy security is guaranteed by an open global market with strong institutional frameworks." That was also one of the biggest issues on the G20 agenda at that particular point in time. Back in 2006, I should also suggest that few would have forecast that oil prices would skyrocket almost $150 US a barrel by July 2008, or that a global financial crisis would see them collapse to as low as $40 in January 2009, recovering today to about $79 a barrel. Ladies and gentlemen, we have seen the same volatility in other energy commodities and mineral resources. The fact is, the supply side was not ready for the China boom, and I might also say this was just not an Australian-specific problem, this was a global problem. In both contexts, we were probably not ready on four fronts. Firstly, investment frameworks. Secondly, production and export infrastructure capacity, skills and labour, and looking to the future, a pipeline of resource projects for development. The challenge for Australia on this occasion is not to make the same mistakes twice. And that is what has occupied the government's mind since we were elected in November of 2007. But let's go to a variety of those issues, dealing firstly with the question of investment. Australia must be ready, willing and able, and above all productive and competitive, to capture its share of the new boom. A lot has therefore been said over recent years on foreign investment and sovereign risk, but I actually think Australia has come a long way on this front. We are a country built on foreign investment, and we continue to welcome it, and so should we. Particularly when it is in our national interest and facilitates the development of Australia's resources for the benefit of all Australians. Our policy is therefore long-standing. It is non-discriminatory, and our government has sought to more clearly define our foreign investment guidelines through our Treasurer on a number of occasions. Whilst there is no hiding from the fact that the relationship between China and India over the last 2 years has faced some difficulties, I believe we have both learnt a lot over that time. Importantly, I believe we are both committed to finding a mutually satisfactory way forward in the resources and energy relationship. And the truth is that we are having more success than failures. By way of example, in 2008-09, more than $26 billion of Chinese investment was approved in the Australian resources sector. Earlier this year, I had the pleasure of speaking at a ceremony here in Sydney formalising the merger between Zhongzhou Coal Mining Limited and Felix Resources, the biggest ever Chinese investment in the Australian coal industry here on the east coast of Australia. That investment alone represented an acquisition of $3.5 billion and represents one of the top 10 mergers and acquisitions undertaken in Australia in 2009, and in my opinion, represents a good deal for both Australia and China. It is a deal, interestingly, that moved beyond the strict producer-consumer relationship and involves technology and expertise exchange. The company in question from China, being a highly experienced long-haul miner historically. Just as the Japan-Australia trade and investment relationship matured and grew into a lasting friendship over the last 50 years, so will the China-Australia relationship, and the next wave to watch, in my opinion, will be India. That takes me to the issue of investor confidence. I know some companies are concerned about what the government's response to the Henry Review will be. We have to be frank over time. Taxation regimes do change. In fact, governments have often responded to requests by industry to adjust taxation arrangements. It is worth remembering that over the course of the last couple of decades, under both Labor and Coalition governments, Australian industry has benefited significantly from ongoing business tax reform. I am confident that this government will continue to deliver taxation reform that is in the best interests of the nation and modernise to deal with the new challenges and opportunities of the 21st century. That then takes me to the question of infrastructure, something that as a shadow minister for three successive elections I actually had to contend with in opposition. And I raise this question because when it comes to infrastructure, we need to continue to move forward with investment in ports, roads and rail access and the all-important question of energy supply. Infrastructure Australia has already commenced work on Australia's first ever national port strategy and a national freight strategy, something that is long overdue in Australia. Actually trying to get state and territory governments and the business sector to actually cooperate with the Commonwealth to actually better plan our infrastructure requirements in Australia. These strategies will hopefully ensure port expansions are accompanied by the necessary landside development, necessary to prevent the bottlenecks which have reduced growth in the last decade. And I say that because, in my opinion, in the lead-up to the global financial crisis, all too often, Australia benefited from increases in commodity prices whilst we lost market share with some fundamental commodities. That's because we failed to invest in our export corridors and also failed to invest in the skilling of Australia. So those reasons, in our budget of last year, on the infrastructure front, we made a significant contribution, a down payment, to start addressing the shortfalls in investment that have included, for example, an additional $580 million for the Hunter Valley Rail projects, which will double coal carrying capacity, an area that has been a major concern to the coal industry over many decades. And that project, being managed by the ARTC, is now making real progress, and industry is satisfied with the progress to date. I then go to a new opportunity, the potential Okajee port, with a Commonwealth contribution on a dollar for dollar basis with the West Australian government of $339 million. For critical common use and infrastructure. Similarly, in the port of Darwin, $50 million for the proposed Darwin port expansion. At the moment, the key port for Australia in terms of uranium exports, which is a major commodity now being sought internationally from Australia, another key energy product and opportunity for Australia. I therefore read with interest the recent speech last week by the Deputy Governor of the Reserve Bank, Rick Bettolino. Interestingly, he sees Australia in the midst of a long-term resources boom, and they're his words, not mine, that started in the mid-2000s, tempered only by the global financial crisis in 2008-09. The boom is driven by emerging economies, mostly China, and on the ground, it is occurring mostly in coal, iron ore and gas, and the supply-side constraints are starting, unfortunately, to reappear. The Deputy Governor notes that mining booms always bring significant economic change and policy changes and challenges, something that is now again confronting the government. He then goes on to warn, and I quote, "Key among these is the need to ensure flexibility in the economy and to maintain disciplined macroeconomic policies to contain the inflationary forces generated by the boom." That in turn takes me to the issue of skills and labour, something that held us back over the previous decade in terms of our capacity to maximise export opportunities. This is particularly important given the state of the labour market here and now. I contend that flexibility is the key, and so is productivity. In many ways, for far too long in recent times, we've actually failed to address the issue of productivity on the ground. Collectively, Employers, unions and governments cannot afford to abandon the goal of productivity growth and the real reforms that have strengthened the Australian economy progressively over the last 30 years. To meet the challenges of the new boom, a new wave of productivity growth is essential. I'm therefore pleased to report that my colleague, Gary Gray, the Parliamentary Secretary for Western Australia and Northern Australia, today released a discussion paper entitled Resourcing the Future, aimed at beginning a new national conversation about these complex but vital issues. He is in charge of a National Resource Sector Employment Task Force that will report to Mark Abib, the Minister for Employment Participation, and myself. That task force having been established by the Prime Minister to address the workforce needs of major resource projects for the next 5 years and beyond. As both Minister for Resources and Energy, and I might say Minister for Tourism, I see the workforce pressures firsthand and is one of the greatest concerns that I have in the current environment. Not just from a resources and energy point of view, but also, I might say, as the Minister for Tourism. And I remind you that tourism in Australia is a major employer. It represents 3.6% of Australia's GDP, but employs directly just under 500,000 Australians in a population of 22 million. And when you think about the wages that are now being agreed to, such as on the Gorgons Construction Agreement in Western Australia, a base rate cleaner trades assistant of $150,000 per annum, then you think about the pressures that is going to bring, for example, to labour-intensive industries such as the hospitality or the retail or the agricultural sectors when the going wage is about $42,000-$45,000 per annum. So just as I'm focused on the labour force needs of all the important portfolio responsibilities I have on resource and energy, I'm equally focused on the challenges I'm going to confront in the labour-intensive sector that I also have responsibility for, namely tourism. But nevertheless, having raised the issues, can I say that it's better to have the problem than have high unemployment, as, for example, is now being experienced in the United States. Just compare, for example, our unemployment rate of about 5.4% to 5.5%, as against the suggested real unemployment rate in the United States of 15% to 20%. So it's a nice problem to have, to manage and to confront. Now I raise that because that takes me to the next challenge, the project pipelines for the future. And I must say things look pretty good for Australia at this particular point in time. I believe that not only do we have to keep an eye on the productive constraints of today, we also have to look to the future and the potential projects we'll have to manage. We need to know where the next Pilbara province is, the next Northwest Shelf, the next Hunter Valley or Bowen Basin. And I say that because just as Australia has been built off the back of intermittent mining booms for the last 160 years, those new resource provinces will also provide the next 160 years of economic opportunity for Australia. It is well known that greenfield mineral exploration is falling compared to total exploration expenditure at just the time we need to be replenishing the stock of economically viable resources for the long term. It is for this reason that the government is considering exploration incentives through the Henry Review, a commitment we made at the last election. But also note that my agency, Geoscience Australia, is vital to keep the project pipeline going for the future generations of Australians. The work of Geoscience Australia provides important pre-competitive exploration data and mapping of Australia's resources to encourage commercial investment in exploration and further resource assessment. If you've got any doubts about that, just ask the Petroleum Ministry, an industry that is also well represented here this evening. That takes me to the issue of Australia's energy resource assessment. Geoscience Australia has also been assisting with the development of the government's energy white paper process over the last year. I am pleased to release this evening the first comprehensive national assessment of Australia's energy resources. That report will be available to guests at the conclusion of my presentation this evening. That assessment has been compiled by Geoscience Australia and ABARE, the Australian Bureau of Agricultural and Resource Economics. It examines Australia's identified and potential energy resources, ranging from fossil fuels and uranium to renewables. It reviews and assesses the factors likely to influence the use of Australia's energy resources to 2030, including the development of cleaner, more efficient energy technologies. The two big findings are the extraordinary potential of coal seam methane and unconventional gas resources, and for the first time, we can see just how extensive Australia's renewable energy resources are. But the energy resource assessment is more than a snapshot of Australia's potential energy resources, so vital to running Australia's economy in the 21st century. It is also, I might say, a national prospectus for energy investment and export opportunities in Australia. It is a very valuable tool for the potential investors in Australia in the development of our resources and energy sector. I believe that if we actually get the settings right, Australia can not only secure its own energy future, but we can also become the premier supplier of energy resources in the Asia-Pacific region. That in turn takes me to the issue of export opportunities. Because in developing our resources and energy products, it's about creating growth and opportunity for Australia, very much focused on export opportunities out of Australia. The challenge of meeting rapidly expanding energy demand on our doorstep here in Asia in a sustainable way is daunting. There are presently, I remind you, 1.6 billion people in the world who do not have access to electricity. As the world's largest exporter of coal, the second largest exporter of uranium, and the fifth and potentially second largest exporter of LNG, Australia's place in this debate is front and centre. The industrialisation and urbanisation taking place in China at present, it is hard to comprehend. By way of example, Australia today has five cities with more than 1 million people. Europe has 35. By 2030, it's estimated that China will have more than 220 such cities. In the same time, 50,000 new Chinese skyscrapers will be built. In the next decade alone, around 1,000 new Chinese coal-fired power stations will be brought online. We'll also see a growth in opportunities for export, both of LNG and uranium, to power the ever-increasing number of nuclear power stations that are currently under construction in China. Australia is therefore, in fact, one of the only three energy-exporting OECD countries, the others being Canada and Norway. So we are part of a very small and select club, and our role and our assets in global energy supply should not be understated. That in turn takes me to our own domestic responsibilities, our energy challenge here at home in Australia. In the same way we have great energy export opportunities to Australia, it's interesting, as an energy-rich nation, we also have challenges here at home. Yes, we are an energy-rich nation. And while the challenge of energy security is important domestically, our biggest challenge is probably the transformation to a low-carbon economy through clean energy technologies, energy efficiency, and ultimately a price on carbon, something that the industry actually accepts must occur. But I then go to the issue of energy efficiency, which is also central to this debate. My department has a responsibility to work with Australia's biggest energy consumers to identify and implement energy efficiency opportunities here in Australia. The 200 businesses included in this program account for nearly one-third of Australia's energy consumption, so it's very important and vital work. The first opportunities report shows Australia's largest energy users have committed to energy savings that will reduce Australia's annual CO2 emissions by 0.7% of 2006-2007 levels. This means business has committed to implementing energy savings that will save them more than $500 million each year. Additional energy efficiency opportunities are still being investigated, and they could see the program reduce Australia's annual greenhouse gas emissions by more than 1%. The efficiencies already committed to will deliver emission reductions equivalent to taking more than 1 million cars off Australian roads. Energy efficiency is therefore a key plank of the Australian government's climate change policy, and this program is delivering real action to reduce greenhouse emissions in our workplaces at this very point in time. It is therefore a timely reminder of how much potential there is for business to both lower their costs and in doing so to reduce their environmental footprint. It also demonstrates the importance of introducing a price on carbon to further drive the uptake of energy efficiency measures, and I will return to this later in my discussion this evening. But I go from energy efficiency to another key part of the debate. Technology created this problem, and technology will be the solution. It's for those reasons that the Australian government unveiled a $4.5 billion clean energy initiative in last year's budget, aimed at accelerating the development and deployment of clean energy technologies and driving down their costs. The clean energy initiative is comprehensive, but it's an important key plank of the government's climate change policy to reduce our carbon emissions through technology development. It includes, for example, the 1.5 billion solar flagships, the 2.4 billion carbon capture and storage flagship, 100 million a year International Carbon Capture and Storage Institute, and a variety of other demonstration programs and institutes, all aimed at a proper focus on technology, which is going to be central to reducing our CO2 emissions. I believe we are giving new clean energy technologies an unprecedented opportunity to actually compete in the marketplace. Solar, wind, geothermal and biomass technologies are moving to the next stage of development. The vast extent of these resources outlined in the energy assessment I released this evening. At the same time, the Australian renewable energy target of 20% by 2020 is driving further investment. In many ways, it represents a subsidy to the renewable sector of the order of about $20 billion. As part of that, the 1.5 billion solar flagship program will deliver large-scale solar power stations feeding solar energy into homes across the nation. In terms of the first round of that program, I'm pleased to report that it targets 400 megawatts of grid-connected solar generation, and the first bid closed on the 15th of February. At that time, my department received a total of 52 applications. Those applications are currently being assessed against the eligibility criteria. While it's in its early days, I am very encouraged by the quality of the applicants and the interest they have shown in this program. However, we cannot ignore the need to also clean up fossil fuels, which will still account for more than 80% of the world's energy output. Central to that is carbon capture and storage. CCS has the potential to reduce carbon emissions from fossil fuels by up to 90%. By reducing emissions from coal and gas-fired electricity, we consolidate their place in the energy mix of the future. The Gorgon Gas Project in Western Australia will be the world's largest commercial carbon capture and storage project in the world, placing Australia at the forefront of CCS demonstration globally. It will store up to 4 million tonnes of CO2 per year, an amount comparable to all the CO2 geologically stored every year globally at the moment. That in turn again raises the complex issue of a price on carbon. We need these new clean energy technologies, but the fact is that, like energy efficiency gains, progress will stall if we don't put a price on carbon. The greatest threat and risk to business confidence in the energy sector particularly the clean energy sector, is the Coalition. How can investors make any decisions about new generation investments when there is no price on carbon? We need, as a nation, around $100 billion of new investment in the energy sector over the next decade alone, just to meet growing demand and replacing ageing infrastructure here in Australia. Without certainty with respect to a price on carbon, investment will continue to stall with respect to need to actually achieve that investment. On top of that, without a price on carbon, there is no driver for large-scale electricity generators to invest in cleaner forms of power generation, such as CCS, gas and renewables such as solar. Ladies and gentlemen, can I say in conclusion, when I last addressed the Institute, I recalled Winston Churchill's consternation about energy security on the eve of World War I. Faced with the fact that the Navy would no longer be able to rely on homegrown coal from Wales, but it would also need oil from Persia, he noted, and I quote, "Safety and certainty in oil lie in variety and variety alone." As Australia and the world face up to the twin challenges of delivering both clean and secure energy supplies in the 21st century, I suggest that that truth still holds. Diversification is the key. In that context, can I say I welcome the opportunity to again address the Institute this evening, because it's an organisation that's actually prided itself on raising very serious issues, policy matters that confront our nation, and I encourage you to continue to do so.
Many thanks, Minister. We'll come to questions and discussion, but before we do, I'd like to say thanks to Mallesons for the use of this fine facility today. You've raised a lot of important issues, but I thought I might just start off with where the students were when they abruptly left, because you're in the process of making a decision about the storage of Australia's uranium waste within Australia. Just give us a bit of the background to where you are with that and why you're doing this.
Well, firstly, because I can understand the concerns of students, because this is a complex debate. I say that because the time has come for Australia to actually confront this complex debate in a mature way. It's very easy to sloganise about the difficulties that we have confronted. We started this process in 1988. It is our waste and it's no one else's waste. We therefore have a responsibility, if we want the ongoing benefits, for example, of nuclear medicine in Australia. And there's probably not a person in this room who hasn't had a family member or a close family friend benefit from nuclear medicine. Over 500,000 Australians per year have the benefit of nuclear medicine. Lucas Heights exists for research purposes and the production of 85% of our medical isotopes. We want to have the ongoing access to this very important medical opportunity. So in 2014-2015, we will receive back from overseas those reprocessed rods. We, under the international protocols, have to safely store our waste. At the moment, it's stored in a variety of places around Australia, including some CSIRO waste from years gone by. But I can't see the difficulty, provided we do it through proper consultation with proper adherence to native title considerations, scientific environmental considerations, why we can't resolve this debate once and for all. Because I actually think it's better than having the waste as is currently stored in a variety of places around Australia, including in filing cabinets and shipping containers and hospitals and universities in our capital cities. So I simply say that our caucus has made a decision. The bill has been introduced to Parliament last week. It will go to debate. I've had discussions with the Coalition, and all being well, there is a maturity in the debate, which means that we will now pass legislation supported by the major political parties in Australia, which will then enable me as the Minister to have a process, which means we will firstly consider the one site that has been voluntarily nominated, that is by the Napa people in the Northern Territory. If that fails for scientific or environmental reasons, or I cannot conclude a proper agreement with the Napa people, then we'll have to look for other voluntary sites in Australia. It will not be imposed without due process in Australia, but I simply say this. There'll be demonstrations, and so be it. But it's time for maturity in Australia, and I think the great majority of Australians understand that. I welcome the demonstrations outside my office. That is one of the challenges of being a minister.
Right, so we continue. There's a question there.
Oh, I'm glad to hear the news about the nuclear waste repository. Following on from that, Minister, do we also feel that the government should also be considering, if we're going to take back our waste, of actually having an enrichment industry, uranium enrichment industry here, so we can sell our uranium at a much higher price?
Look, first let's consider where we're at the moment. Firstly, it's only in the last 4 years that both major political parties actually embraced a more aggressive policy with respect to the development of Australian uranium. Because it's only in the last parliament that there was a proper focus by both major parties on the uranium mining industry in Australia. I might say it was through the Industry Resources and Energy House Committee. You actually look back at the previous decade, I think we only got one additional mine in Australia, in South Australia. We also fueled some of our domestic nuclear power plants in the United States off old Soviet warheads. Hence, there wasn't the demand for uranium. The world has now changed. Nuclear power is part of the clean energy debate internationally. It will grow in importance. In terms of Australia, well, we as a government have a policy which does not include nuclear power, nor does it include enrichment. Where's the debate in Australia at the moment? I consider it's at this point. Young people have an open mind, and all the available public opinion polls have proved that. It's people in their late 40s, 50s, 60s who came through the nuclear disarmament debate that have a more closed mind on these issues. The debate has reared its head in Australia in the past and will continue to rear its head, but in terms of the current government's policy position, it is no to nuclear power and enrichment. But in terms of enrichment, I might say there's a complex international debate going on, driven, for example, out of the Nuclear Suppliers Group in the United States and the Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna, as to whether or not the world should select a small number of trusted countries to actually have the responsibility to actually go down the enrichment path, for the purposes of also enabling us to more closely focus on the complex issue of nuclear disarmament. That is the debate that has occurred with some progress in recent years. It will also, in my opinion, go forward out of the Gareth Evans process aimed at trying to review and modernise the nuclear protocol going to disarmament, which will go to then how we properly consider internationally access to nuclear energy for domestic purposes.
Question. As to sustainable energies, you didn't mention the possibility of using tidal energy. Oh. It seems that several countries are doing more research than us here in Australia, and yet look at the length of our coastal areas.
Well, I apologise, that was an oversight in the preparation of the speech. In actual fact, I have given a grant to test ocean power at Portland in Victoria. Under the Renewable Industry Development Program, we've actually made a grant available to Victoria in the same way which we've made over $200 million available, for example, for geothermal research. We've got the $1.5 billion program for solar. So ocean power is very much part of the R&D that is underway in Australia with government support. And I must say, this energy assessment is important for that reason, because it actually maps the best potential areas in Australia to develop the different renewable opportunities.
Hi, Minister. I was just contemplating as you yeah. were providing that overview, that in the North Sea oil area, yeah. the UK squandered, well, some people might say squandered their opportunity, the resources that they have, because Norway put aside a lot of the money that they derive from that resource. Have you thought about a comparable future fund or energy fund for Australia where we might be able to invest for future generations or infrastructure or other priorities for the government?
I actually think we're in the process of investing the proceeds of our development to date and actually positioning Australia to develop over the next 10, 20, 30 years. That's why I've referred this evening to how we've invested some of the proceeds of that growth to date in key infrastructure opportunities. Because actually investing in those infrastructure requirements actually brings in new investment, which then assists us in returning the budget surplus and building up further investment funds for the future. It's not a question, you know, we obviously have a future fund, but obviously there's also a requirement to actually create a bigger cake in the future to actually invest in fundamental requirements such as infrastructure and skills, which will create an even bigger opportunity in the future for us to live off as a nation. That's why I say resource and energy is going to be very central to where this economy is right throughout the 21st century.
Andrew Robin.
Minister, my question concerns the long-term national security of Australia. Could you give us our views? Do you think it's in the national interest in our resources sector any foreign government, through its arms or agencies, should be allowed to purchase any of our natural resources?
Well, every investment in Australia is actually independently considered on merit for the Foreign Investment Review Board, the responsibility of the Treasurer. And that means, for example, yes, more often than not, we approve foreign investment in Australia. But we do have a capacity to actually reject some foreign investment. And I can think of a decision by the Treasurer last year on the rare earths issue, where there was an endeavour by Chinese interests to actually further invest in Australian rare earths, at the same time of which China had put export controls in place with respect to the export of their own rare earths. That's why we've got a non-discriminatory policy, but each application will be considered on its merits, and the national interest test is very important to Australia. And the very issue that you have raised is something that the Foreign Investment Review Board and the Treasurer have regard for. But can I also say, because, you know, you're no doubt referring, for example, with the question of China, the same sensitivities in Australia that relate to China today related to Japan 30 and 40 years ago. It's a question of us managing those investments, because without foreign investment in Australia, then we don't have an economic future. We have a big savings pool, but it's not big enough to actually develop our natural resources to the benefit of all Australians.
Question there. Yes.
Thank you, Minister. I was wondering if you considered not citing the waste dump on Aboriginal land. It's going to drive the weeds through an Aboriginal community. It's going to create a lot of divisions, a lot of suffering. And there's also the whole problem of the South, you know, dumping waste in the North, taking the Northern Territory, which is an easy target. Have you considered a site in South Australia, Western Australia, or in the south of the continent, not
even Australians have considered a variety of sites continually since 1988. But every time the Commonwealth Government sought to do something, there's been a campaign not in my backyard. I might say a bit like some of the campaigns that are now emerging. I hear a lot of discussion about the need for renewables. I go to Ballarat now and I see campaigns, we don't want a wind farm in our backyard. I go to the Otways where there's a great opportunity for geothermal energy, and there's a campaign now, not in my backyard. You actually get to a point where government has to be decisive. Time is not on our side. Successive governments of all political persuasions have considered a variety of sites. But you raise the issue of Indigenous people. It was the Indigenous community, the Napa people, that actually volunteered Muckaty. The only site that is before me on a voluntary basis. I didn't select it, nor did the Howard government. It was volunteered. But yes, some of the surrounding affected communities have expressed some concerns. The process I have established requires full and proper consultation, including with the surrounding communities. I regard this process no different, for example, to the challenge in the Kimberleys, where the Kimberley Land Council has nominated Broome as a potential LNG hub. Some of the other clans, the affected people, have some concerns about it. The same way which, for example, be it a uranium mine in the Northern Territory historically or an iron ore mine in Western Australia. Often we get agreement with traditional owners in a given area, as Warren appreciates, but then some of the people in what is described as affected regions have concerns, and through proper negotiations and a capacity to actually manage, for example, foundations and assistance, you can normally resolve those issues. We will not impose it. It will be by full and proper consultation, for regard for the land rights under the Northern Territory legislation, environmental and scientific consideration. What I also say, one of the problems emerging in the Australian community at the moment is the Indigenous community has now commenced to break with the Green Movement and determine that, well, we are actually going to make our own decisions on the basis of what is in our best interests, not what we are told by the well-heeled people out of Melbourne and Sydney.
There's a question right down the back, yes?
So you spoke of the need for diversity. Is there a risk that we're too dependent in the long term on the energy demands of China alone?
Of course, China's important. But so are our traditional long-term customers, Japan, Korea. You know, they're very important markets to Australia. We're not going to put all our eggs in one basket. Take the Gorgon LNG project, a huge export opportunity to China, but also for the first time ever, long-term export contract with Korea, export opportunities in Japan. Also, I might say, the first ever substantial LNG contract to India. So yes, China's important for investment at the moment, but the markets we are developing in terms of demand for coal, pretty well established. China is new. Japan and Korea are old friends on the coal front. Uranium, China is new. Japan is a long-term participant in the uranium mining industry in Australia. LNG, well, the new contracts, as Russell appreciates, being pursued on the West Coast and the East Coast from a long-term export opportunity, they're not focused on any individual country, industry, and its commercial decisions for individual companies, are seeking to negotiate long-term contracts in a variety of countries.
Question over here.
In regards to Australia's rich endowment of energy, the one thing that we seem to have a weakness in is that probably the most desired of all energies, and that's oil. You know, given that the Southern Hemisphere only has about 3% of the world's oil resources, you know, the chances of finding major deposits are probably a long shot at best. And given that Australia's the demographic of Australia, the cities are built around cars, there's no fuel efficiency standard, require heavy users of imports a lot. What's the idea about for that?
Well, transport fuels are very important. Clearly, in terms of oil, just in terms of exploration, the work of Geoscience Australia and all the pre-competitive work is very important. But also indicate that we have a second generation biofuels program, which we've put out some investment dollars for the private sector and research institutes in Australia. And I must say, one of the potential real focuses has got to be on algae. And when I was in the United States earlier this year, I had key discussions with a number of countries that are actually looking for the opportunities to develop alternative fuels in Australia based on algae. And they nominated, for example, three areas in Australia that they had assessed as being potentially very important to actually produce the algae in Australia around a variety of coastal opportunities in Australia. I can also say to you, a number of the major petroleum companies are actually participating in Australia's development of the petroleum industry are also major investors in alternative fuels, including algae. So it's not something that we are dismissing. We regard it as very important. And I might say traditional suppliers of oil, the petroleum industry is also having a hard look at, because they've got to also think about their future.
Richard Morris.
You talked a little bit about skills in the context of maybe skills shortages, and also about innovation in some key areas. Can you say a little about how the universities in Australia are aligned to produce people with the skills for the future? I'm conscious in the UK, for example, there are around 34,000 students in environmental sciences and technologies. But so are Australian universities determined to provide people for the longer term with the skills Australia needs to take advantage of its resources?
I think it's fair to say there's been some criticism of industry over years gone by about whether or not in particular skill areas there was sufficient focus, for example, on engineering in some of our universities. That's also because there was a lack of interest amongst our own students with respect to actually pursuing these career opportunities. I actually think young people are now responding to the career opportunities that are emerging in Australia's resources and energy sector. Therefore, the demand for courses required in these areas of work is actually forcing universities to actually do more with respect to some of these faculties. It's also meant that industry, because of the need to actually pursue this requirement in universities, has actually engaged more closely with the universities, setting up research opportunities in the universities, foundations, and I might say offering cadetships to the students. For example, in engineering, a matter of 18 months ago, the cadets were actually being signed up in their first year by the major companies in Western Australia with guarantees of summer employment for the purpose of actually getting them with connections to individual companies. So in a lot of ways, I think we're in catch-up mode, but there is an acceptance in universities to actually now have a closer regard for the demands of industry than perhaps might have been the case 10 years ago. That's how I see it, and that's how industry also sees it, because industry itself now regards that close connection with universities, especially in our resource-rich states, as being central to their future.
We're getting near the end. There's a question up the back there.
Yeah. Mining's always been transitory and up and down, and it's huge at the moment. Can you see, and I noticed the other day the Premier of Western Australia was asking for consideration in terms of the agreement between the states and the carving up of the GST main, I think it was, consideration because of the huge growth in the West and the needs that they have for infrastructure and whatever. I don't think he got what he wanted. But can you see, Frank, how this might change Australia socially, demographically, and what are some of the tensions that might come out of this? Will states be like Victoria and Tasmania, feel they're left behind, that sort of thing?
I just interrupt for a minute. In view of the time, I think we'd better make this the last question.
Sure.
Okay.
Thank you. Firstly, in terms of Western Australia, he actually got what he wanted on infrastructure with a bigger outlay from the Commonwealth, but he got reduced on some of the... he got a reduction, if I remember correctly, on some of the recurrent funding because of the way the formula works in the review of the grants. Yes, we are aware of the potential problems of areas such as Western Australia. For example, I'm in regular discussion with Colin Barnett, the Premier of WA, about the pressures in the petroleum sector on places such as Karratha. And just in terms, for example, of if we actually get the Broome LNG hub up and running, there was a very important announcement last week with respect to an agreement with the Indigenous people about land release and the potential creation of subdivisions for residential development, which has been one of the biggest drawbacks in the development of the Karratha region, a lack of land for residential development. Yes, we are aware potentially of two-speed economy. Very much aware of it. And we are having proper regard for this issue from a Commonwealth point of view. But can I also remind you that in terms of trying to avoid that difficulty, a Gorgon LNG project does not just bring benefits to Western Australia. It actually creates demand for manufactured components from all around Australia, from Newcastle to Geelong to Rockhampton. And that's what you will see out of projects such as Gorgon. The three partners are very much focused on Australian content, but we have to be competitive. There's no way you can expect an investor in Australia for a particular contract to pay three times what it might be able to get the same quality product from overseas. So hence I raise the issue this evening of productivity. We can't compete on wages and conditions. We have higher standards of living, so we've actually got to be more productive. But in terms of actually managing some of these projects, I might also say, as is raised in Gary Gray's report today, the Australian workforce is actually going to be more mobile. You can go to Cowra at the moment, where a plane goes each fortnight to actually work on the east coast, on the west coast. On the Pluto construction project at the moment, a Leighton's project, one in four of the construction workers actually comes from the east coast of Australia. People are going to follow the work because it's going to bring opportunities. 2 weeks on, 1 week off. And even in Cairns, can I say, in terms of a two-speed economy, Japan for Cairns for too long depended on tourists out of Japan. Japanese economy's had some difficulties for some years. I don't see the Japanese tourism market being what it was in the past in Cairns in the future. So I've actually been having discussions up there. Why shouldn't Cairns be considered as a resource sector supplying labour, the same way in which Townsville, Mackay or Gladstone? So what we're seeking to do is actually meet our labour force needs to actually avoid some of the tensions that you could get with one area of Australia surging ahead and others falling behind by changing the nature of how we service this economy from a skilled point of view. So can I say, your right to raise it is something that occupies the government's mind, I must say, my mind on a regular basis. How do we manage the labour force demands of these projects whilst at the same time spreading the benefits through Australian content and labour supply opportunities across the whole of Australia? By way of example, if these two pulp mills in Tasmania close, as they're going to in the next couple of weeks, then you're going to have a large number of highly skilled Tasmanians who, just as in the past, have followed work on the mainland. They'll become part of the fly-in, fly-out national workforce. And Tasmania will benefit because they will be high-paid workers taking big wage packets back to Tasmania and spending that money in the local economies. Thank you for the opportunity to actually address you this evening.
Many thanks. Many thanks to the Minister. There were more questions, but we're right on 7 o'clock, and I'm sorry, I just couldn't take it. The Minister's launching his Australian Energy Resource Assessment document today. I think it's down the back. I'll be very brief. Martin Ferguson, I think, has been one of the star performers of the Rudd government, and you can see why tonight. A very empirical and practical person who's very much on top of his portfolio in probably what is one of the most important responsibilities in the Cabinet. So we're delighted that Mr. Ferguson could find time to come to us tonight to give an important talk and launch a significant document. No doubt he'll be back in the future, but for tonight I'd just like to say well done and all the best. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.